Joining us today, former childhood star and star of Happy Days, award-winning director Ron Howard, next on The Dusty Wright Show at culturecatch.com. Today's show is brought to you by our friends at Sony. For professionals who depend on HD, they depend on Sony. Experience Pro HDNA today. Visit them at pro.sony.com. This is Dusty Wright with The Culture Catch today. Very excited to have Mr. Ron Howard, one of our favorite directors.
Thank you, thank you.
Thanks for having us here in Connecticut.
Up in the editing digs.
The editing, it is packed downstairs. He's in the middle of an edit as we speak. But Ron, first of all, congratulations on Frost Nixon.
Thank you.
We saw the movie the other night, and it's spectacular. Now, I must say I'm handicapped. I didn't see the play. Right. But I'm curious, when you saw the play, was it an immediate for you for a film adaptation?
It was so immediate that I did something I've never done ever, which is I literally left the theater and called Brian Grazer, my partner in Imagine Films, you know, and called my agent and said, I don't want to just develop this. I want to make it. I'll commit to making it next. And they were, I think everybody was a little shocked because they've never heard me, you know, sort of jump in with both feet like that. But I was so surprised by what I was experiencing in the play. And I'd read it. I knew I liked it. That's why I was there. I thought it could be a movie. But it was enlightening. That I sort of expected. It was so much more engrossing and suspenseful and entertaining in a very surprising, unusual and intelligent way that I, you know, and I also began to just feel it could be a movie. I just began to get a sense of it.
Plus, it's part of our history, you know, people our age, you know. Mm-hmm. I kind of remember the interview, you know.
I do. They were big to me. I was 23 at the time, in 1977, and I was one of those, they say 400 million people worldwide watch those interviews. Well,
you were there.
I was there.
Yeah.
And it was very significant to me. And what's interesting about what Peter Morgan, the screenwriter, who also wrote the play, and also wrote The Queen and Last King of Scotland last year, and he's a brilliant guy, and he's really on a roll. But, you know, what he did was, for all of us who sort of think we know what the story was, whether we watched the interviews or read about them or vaguely remember them or remember them like they happened yesterday, is you just have no idea what the human interest story is going on behind the scenes. Mm. And that's what he uncovered and really knew how to write. And it's what I think makes the story so surprising for people.
It really is compelling, we're so voyeuristic as a society, I guess. So we want to see everything behind the scenes. We want to see how people operate.
Well, especially these people.
Yeah.
You know, I think part of what appealed to Peter, and it certainly appealed to me, is that David Frost is a very colorful, very engrossing, very entertaining person. You know, Richard Nixon was, a fascinating person. When you talk to the people who worked for Frost or the people who worked for Nixon, they're hilarious as they talk to you about them. You know, I mean,
yeah.
they start imparting all these incredibly fascinating little details, facts, nuances, foibles, and they can't help themselves.
Right.
You know, these are the kind of characters that you want to get under their skin. You want to understand a little more about them. And the more you do, you know, the more engrossing they become.
How much of the story is true? You know, from the play version to the movie. I know I've read what you've done to pump up the movie a little bit.
Well, the story is, you know, sort of just the big arc of the story is very true.
Very true, right.
You know, and the particulars of the interviews are taken from the transcripts. Now,
okay.
You know, I mean, that was Frost shot 21 hours of tape to get four 90-minute interviews. And we probably have 17, 18 minutes of actual interviews. Well, Peter Morgan grabbed bits from all the interviews and collapsed them into, you know, a compelling version, concise. But you know, those are, you know, 90%. Once in a while, he might invent a phrase just to bridge from one line to another or something, you know. But those are the transcripts. The everything that's going on around it is all born out of research. And then what happens in the sort of one-on-one scenes between Frost and Nixon, where nobody really knows exactly what might or might not have been said, that's supposition and invention. And that is inspired still by the research because, you know, what Peter Morgan did in writing it was learn a lot about these guys. And so he tried to find ways to dramatize it. And so, yes, this scene probably never happened between these two guys.
The phone call scene.
Phone call is the biggest example of that. But Nixon was known to make sort of crazy late night phone calls that he couldn't remember the next day. And this was like within his circles, people knew.
That's a possibility.
There were lots of interactions between Frost and Nixon. Sometimes Nixon was being a little intimidating. Sometimes he was trying to cajole. Sometimes he was trying to seduce. Same thing with Frost. Right. So, yes, they had private conversations. Yeah. Did they have anything quite as supercharged? Probably not, but it also just tells us so much, and as you know, and this is where the drama comes in, about who the guys are and what's at stake for them, that I think it's sort of the perfect example of a writer taking creative license. So, it's not a docudrama.
Right.
It's not a literal recreation, but I really think it gets at the tone, the spirit, the real an honest sense of what, you know, what the event was like.
Absolutely. This is one of the rare films that translates and moves from stage to screen, which is such a difficult thing. I mean, obviously having the writer involved and having the same characters and the same actors. Was there resistance, do you think? Or
a little bit from, you know, not so much with Michael Sheen for Frost. Because, he looks, a lot like Frost. Everybody saw him.
And he came off the Queen playing Tony
Blair.
Blair.
Yeah. But, you know, that was a box office success as well as a critical success. So it was quickly, very easy to quickly look around and say, who else could do that? Probably no one better.
Right.
And he certainly has his grasp of the character. Frank Langella is nothing like Richard Nixon.
Right.
He doesn't look like Richard Nixon. His personality is not like Richard Nixon. So he created this great persona on stage. But you tend to typecast a little bit more. You tend to look for somebody who somehow has something more of the essence of the character. So both creatively and from a box office standpoint, it wasn't as easy to sort of say, and absolutely Frank Langella, even though he was wonderful in it. But he was always in the back of my mind a really viable candidate. And as we explored, talked to the studio, thought about it amongst ourselves, lots of Academy Award winning actors.
Did you audition any of them?
I didn't, no.
All right.
No, didn't audition anybody. There were some people who actually just spontaneously sent in unsolicited tapes.
Right.
And just said, you know, please don't put this, you know, on the internet.
Right.
But, you know, between you and me, this would be a blast and this would be my take on it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they were great. But what it started to be not about who could do it and how good would they be. There were a lot of people who would be good. It was how great Frank was becoming. And the longer he played, you know, then he came to the U.S. He's nominated for Tonys. The reviews are spectacular. Anybody else was going to be walking in his shadow. And, you know, that performance had continued to evolve and deepen. And as a director, I became really, covetous and greedy about wanting those nuances in the film. I wanted audiences to see what this guy had to offer.
You forget who Nixon was almost by his performance. You know, you say, okay, I remember what Nixon looked like, but he completely inhabits
the
character so well. It's not even an issue when you're watching the movie.
You know, and I was careful to try to sort of immerse the audience a little bit, or slowly draw them into the Frank Langella version of the mm-hmm. the character. Whereas in the play, he comes right out, and for the first 4 or 5 minutes, you're sort of saying, well, you know, you're just judging in physicality. Right. Yeah, well, he doesn't look much like Nixon. I guess he sounds a little like him. And then soon he wins you over. Well, I didn't feel like we had that luxury with this. Right. So I actually started off with Nixon's voice. We have the Nixon tapes.
The tapes, right.
Playing under the credits. And then we drift over, and for a while you just kind of catch glimpses of the Langella version. And then the first time you see him, it's black and white TV.
Right.
And slow, by the time you're really into the movie and he's got real scenes, you know, people are won over because he
clever.
Wins you over. Yeah. He's remarkable.
Yeah. I thought Kevin Bacon was very good, too. Kevin is one of those great chameleon actors,
yeah.
whatever role he inhabits.
Yeah, well, you know, they all, look, all, we got this
the
fantastic
cast,
supporting
yeah,
cast.
Oliver, everyone, yeah.
Sam Rockwell, Oliver Platt, yeah. Rebecca Hall, you know, Toby Jones, Matthew McFadden. And I mean, it really is as remarkable a supporting cast as I've ever really been involved with. And, right. I've had some great casts that I've been able to work with in a bunch of movies. But they just loved the writing, you know, and they loved what it was about. Look, it's so original. This is why I jumped on it. There's nothing you can compare it to. There's nothing else like it. And that's harder and harder to be able to say about it, about any stories that any of us can find to make.
Well, that was going to be one of my questions to you, Ron, is, you know, everything, you know, they keep rehashing, you know, they take European movies and try to Americanize them and everything. I mean, for you, someone who's been so successful, it's always, I mean, what do you look for in a story? Is it the character arc? Is it the payoff at the end in the third act?
It's pretty simple, but I really do read it first and foremost kind of like an audience member. And
Where'd you go see this movie?
How engrossed am I?
Yeah.
How fascinated am I? And then it goes through a little more analytical process where basically I have to determine whether I want to put, you know, a year and a half into it. Also, you know, the energies of the team that I work with, because they'll, you know, if I say I'm going for it, they'll jump in behind it, and sure, they'll get paid, but you know, their careers depend on it being good, you know, as well.
Yeah.
But it's kind of, for me, it reaches a point where, you know, if I get sort of jealous of it, if I start to feel like, God, I'm gonna kick myself if anybody else gets to make this and I don't. Well, then I know that on a number of levels, it's, you know, it's screaming at me to go ahead and jump in. I have to feel like I've got something to offer it.
Right.
I have to feel like I understand it on some nuanced level so I can bring something to it that I think I can, that audiences you know, might get something out of. And you know, and how fresh and interesting is it? That's what I like about the Dan Brown stories.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
Did you
read those originally just as leisurely reading, or
no,
do you always?
I only ever read it as, you know,
as a potential project. Yeah.
And my wife had read them both, Da Vinci Code and Angels and Demons, and had talked about them. You know, the guys who created 24. Were the first ones to tip Brian Grazer off to it. They just said, "Wow, this is so cool!" And these plot twists, and you know, they love.
Yeah.
Of course, they love all that. And they're very challenging adaptations. Angels and Demons, the one that I've just finished shooting, is much more of a movie story. You know, it's literally a ticking bomb story. It's a thriller. It's a mystery, and it really works on all those levels. And for me, it was very satisfying to work on because it was unlike anything that I've done. Maybe closest would be Ransom, but this is more mystery,
right?
You know, and less and following the plot points. Da Vinci Code, you know, just had such dealt on a thematic level, is so. Out there.
It's very dense.
And kind of, but you know, to get to make a movie that deals with things like the sacred feminine and the dogma of the church and challenges audiences to, you know, to really think through their belief systems and all that sort of thing. Well, that's the kind of stuff that, you know, you'd be lucky to get a studio to give you $1.5 million to make that film.
Absolutely.
And
good
yet,
point.
Here what Dan Brown did was found, you know, using a popular genre, created a story that, you know, managed to entertain and still raise these questions and points. I found the combination of that to be irresistible. And he just takes his Robert Langdon characters into such fascinating worlds and realms. And it's this blend of sort of action and ideas that's, you know, it's tricky filmmaking, but really original.
Did you find it, I mean, obviously with Da Vinci, there's so much expose.
It's
so hard. How do you, you know, translating that? Obviously, well, it was the biggest challenge, I suspect, for that.
A huge challenge to deal with the history, and so much of that story exists in the past.
Right.
And then trying to keep the tension going in the present while you're delving into, you know, the history that's still influencing things, various times, periods in our history and in world history, but. At a certain point you sort of say there's something about the ideas being dealt with here that are meaningful to people.
Right.
I mean it's not necessarily how tight a narrative is this. Mm-hmm. You know, if you compare it beat by beat with other movies of a similar genre, it sort of can't compete, and yet the ideas being bandied about and being explored somehow just captured everyone's imagination. And
right.
So it was really doing, you know, a motion picture version of the Da Vinci Code.
Right.
It was a little less about making a standalone movie.
Right.
But I had a great time doing it, and it was fascinating work. Box office was remarkable.
Right.
But I've never done a sequel before, and yet Angels and Demons, in many ways, doesn't really.
It's
even
a prequel,
feel,
isn't it?
Well, we made it as a sequel.
Okay.
But essentially, you know, it's very much a standalone movie with its own tone and style.
When I read both of them, for some reason, I felt that Angels and Demons read as better literature, you know,
well,
just looking at it as a written word thing. I don't know if that's just me or
a lot of people have said that, but again, it's sort of the you know, as a story that, you know, that gets going and takes off and roars.
Right.
You know, it definitely, you know, Angels and Demons has all that, and yet it still transports you into you know, a very unusual sort of mysterious realm behind the scenes at the Vatican. And so, you know, it was really interesting to work on. Dan Brown's working on a third one. I have no idea really what it's going to be, or, you know, he's been working on it for years. You know, I don't know whether it'll be a movie.
Will you get to see a first draft on it, do you think?
We'll see how much
you see the manuscript.
See how well Dan likes Angels and Demons, I guess.
Did he like Da Vinci Code? Did he like your adaptation?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah. Do you think there's more openness at the studios now to tackle movies? You have the success of Cormac McCarthy, you know, his new movies coming out the road. Is America getting smarter with the movies we're making?
I think that the Sundance Film Festival, which kind of gets maligned a little bit now, like it's kind of gone mainstream,
too commercial,
or something. But but I'll tell you, I think what Redford did there and what's come out of that festival has been the greatest thing for American filmmaking and even Hollywood filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
Of anything in my lifetime, maybe since they developed the rating system and films could become more realistic,
right.
You know,
yeah.
But it's basically exposed more and more audiences to subjects which are less formulaic and less, you know, following the traditional narrative lines of Hollywood movies, and it's making possible, in a way, the kind of filmmaking ideas that were sometimes emerging through Hollywood back in the 30s.
Mm.
And
like the Preston Sturges movies? Or
offbeat ideas that just, you know, a studio executive was willing to make take a run at, you know, because the investments weren't, if they were modest investments, they were willing to take some chances then. And then, of course, in the 70s, influenced by Europe, things really opened up. That was a very bold period. And yet, the you know, if you were to look back at kind of how all those movies performed, Hollywood turned away from them because they actually couldn't stay afloat, you know, making, you know, The Last Detail. Or, you know, as cool as that movie is.
Or
that was probably, that actually was probably, you know, profitable. Maybe Five Easy Pieces.
I was going to say
something
Five
like,
Easy Pieces.
You know,
or...
these movies were not keeping the studios afloat.
Yeah. Even Mean Streets, that wasn't financially significant
but they,
at all, but it
great
created
movies.
A genre.
It created a genre.
Yeah.
But so what's happened is, and here's a this is a hell of a long answer, is, you know, things went towards spectacle and more genre movies through the 80s and 90s.
Right.
Sundance developed its footing, and there is an audience, and a studio is willing to suddenly say, Frost Nixon, yeah, maybe we'll take a shot.
Right.
Or Brokeback Mountain, yeah,
right.
Well, you know, Milk. Okay, we'll help you find. However, you know, the creative, you know, the filmmakers involved, the actors, they can't be, you know, they don't expect to get paid what they would be paid for, you know, a genre movie that's easy to market.
Right, right.
And so there's kind of this understanding that there's an actual business model out here that can be applied to movies that are more. You know, more unusual, more ambitious thematically, I suppose you might say, less easy to market, and you know, I'm very excited about this holiday season.
Right.
You know, there are a bunch of movies,
lots of movies
that are really different,
yeah,
really different, really unusual subjects that I haven't seen before.
Wait till you see The Wrestler with Mickey Rourke.
I'm very eager to see that. Oh. I haven't seen it yet, but
The
you know,
Reader. I mean, there's so
it's
many
a good
wonderful.
Year.
Yeah, there's a
I think
lot.
It's a really, really good year. I'm proud that Frost Nixon is in the mix.
Yeah, absolutely. Great answer, even though it was long. Do you ever hanker to do an indie movie with unknowns? Have you thought? You know, you've done so many styles of movies. Big.
Well, I've got this movie starring Michael Sheen and Frank Langella, who aren't quite unknowns, but it, you know, it's not exactly Hanks or Russell Crowe or Mel Gibson.
Good answer.
But you know, look, the distribution systems are changing, and it's in some ways it's possible to go out and make a movie, and even trying to nurture along the company like Imagine Films, which you know has employees. We need to make X number of movies. We need them to be commercially viable whenever possible. But but we also all have a desire to try to be a part of great projects. Well, it's not outrageous to assume you could find a little gem of a script and go make it in months, not years.
Right.
And sort of, it's a little bit like you know people saying, "I'm going to do this off Broadway play for 3 months, you know, and you do it because you believe in it and creatively, and technology is making that possible, and there is a distribution system now which, you know, it used to be if you made a film like that, unless you hit some kind of remarkable bullseye, like, you know, you won the Palme d'Or at Cannes or the Academy Award, no one would even see your movie.
Right.
So it's, you know, it was like really, you know, putting all your money on double zero on the roulette wheel or something. Now if you make a film that is compelling and works, by hook or by crook, it'll find an audience.
Right.
You know, it might not be the glorious opening weekend that everyone dreams of, but it'll get out there, and that, I think that's just great for the art form.
Is that part of the reason for doing Arrested Development? Isn't that in development for
future?
We're
working on it. Well, you know, that has a following, so I mean, I think.
But it was a cult following, like, you know, it's unfortunately got canceled because it was, you know, everyone loved, anyone wanted smart TV loved that show.
It was so much fun to be a part of that show, and everyone involved loved it, and it never got sort of big enough numbers to really work as a television show. I wasn't angry at anybody when they finally let it go, but there are, it did prove that, you know, there are millions of hardcore fans.
And
because of downloading and stuff, it's, you know, it's just proven to have a tremendous afterlife without even being in traditional television syndication.
And that's the beauty of the internet, because it's doing all your marketing for you. The pre-release marketing for something like this, the internet will be buzzing about it.
Well, so, know? I mean, I think we get a good script, and it's good enough to make it, and we do it, and it's going to be made very modestly. Mitch would direct it himself. I think it's probably not a movie would have to get discovered. I think there'd be an audience there for it already.
It's already attached. Who are some of your favorite directors or movies? You know, you mentioned the 30s. Do you, as a film, obviously you're passionate about movies and.
Yeah, well, the first movie that really, really woke me up, and even though I'd been a kid actor, and I understood what it was to work on shows and movies, and I saw what the creative process was like, and I even, hoped to be a part of that someday. I still didn't quite get entirely what a director could do. And when I saw The Graduate and saw what Mike Nichols did with that film, it was the first movie that I went back and really studied. And it was done with such style, and I understood the power of just the compositions and the timing. And I just felt the hand of the director. Not in a self-conscious way, but in a way, because the first time I saw it, I just was lost in it, and I just completely immersed. And the first few times I saw it, it was that way. I would just get caught up in Ben's story, And then I began to see that it wasn't just straightforward. There were a lot of really unusual cinematic ideas working there. And, Bonnie and Clyde sort of did that for me. Right. And there was a great, really rich period of great movies that Zeffirelli's Romeo and Juliet. I couldn't believe that I could feel so much about Shakespeare and be drawn back into history in that way. And I really began to understand that there were a lot of different ways to approach a story, and the person who really had to make those choices was the director.
2001 for me was that moment. Because I remember it was like 6th or 7th grade, and my mother would often drop my brother and I off for the Saturday matinees, and it was just so abstract.
Yeah,
and I'd never, and it questioned, the question of your religion, everything about it, the imagery. I walked out of that just never the same looking at movies.
Just
there's something that happens. I guess when you start thinking abstractly about the world,
and
those movies seem to just. They define you as an individual.
Well, that was a great era. That was a fantastic era, I like to think that 20, 30 years from now, people might look back on this period and sort of say, there was some interesting work going on.
Do you have a favorite movie in your library, your canon, that you've directed or produced or been involved with?
I don't have a favorite, but I sort of have a top 4 or 5.
Okay.
I'm not going to tell you. because here's what happened. I used to answer that question. And not so much with journalists. They were happy to get an answer. But if I would be talking to, say, students about it or just hanging around with friends and it would come up, inevitably I'd leave off the one of mine that they liked the most.
Right.
And I sort of realized that, or I'd even worse, slag a little bit on their favorite one. Because of course they're all personal to me, and I there are things I love and things that I regret about them all and so forth. But I decided to shut up about that because I make them for a reason, my own reasons. I give it everything I've got. I know what I feel about the movie, but I really think then it becomes, it's up to the viewer.
That's good. That's how Lynch felt as well. I think most great directors feel that way. It's like once it's out there, it's up to you to determine. I've captured the moment.
And you never want to take away from, somebody who might actually like the one you don't.
God forbid. What a great, That's classic. Something that I think, I've read this and I feel this as well. The Andy Griffith Show, the writing still holds up today. And I sometimes make my 10-year-old watch it with me. I say, this writing is, he's like, why, Dad? I said, because it was never political,
right?
But it was moral. And every show had a theme that,
that's well put. Yeah.
You know, There's something about the writing that is in the acting, obviously, in the cast that you worked with.
It was pretty remarkable, and you just you have to give so much of the credit to Andy Griffith, because he was never formally, you know, the creator of the show or the head writer of the show, and you know, Aaron Rubin in particular ran the show for the first 5 years, and he was, you know, pretty kind of a television genius and a great writer, but there was just a completely unique tone and quality to that. And I always think, you were asking me about favorite directors.
Yeah.
Frank Capra is one of mine.
Okay.
And I always think they were almost like Capra stories.
Okay.
Each and every one. And it turns out that Sheldon Leonard, who was one of the
producers, right?
The exec producers.
The exec producer,
And had a lot of influence on the show. You know, he was in the Frank Capra stock company of character actors.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And he died before I ever had a chance to ask him this question. But I always wondered if in some way he viewed them in similar terms, particularly the first 5 years of the show that was black and white.
Yeah, yeah.
You look at it, there's something about the rhythm, the blend of humor and sort of philosophy or moral code.
Yeah.
That... You know, I think there's some kind of thread there, you know, but it's a completely unique television show.
It really is.
And, you know, one of the things that I was so proud of was I chose to do through Funny or Die this endorsement for Barack Obama. And I had never publicly endorsed a candidate before. Mm-hmm. And I had the idea. I ran it by Judd Apatow and Adam McKay, and Adam got very excited about it and started writing it up and sending it back to me and saying, "We'll help you with Funny or Die," and I sent the pages to Henry Winkler and told him the idea, and he instantly said, "Absolutely, we got to do this."
Right.
And then, once I had Henry's yes in hand, with some trepidation, I called Andy because I've never really talked politics with Andy. You know?
Right.
And he said, "I'm a Democrat. We need a Democrat, and we need it to be Barack Obama." And I didn't even get my question out. He was so excited about doing it, you know. And I was, and then I knew we had to, you know, that we had to go ahead with it. But we never contacted the Obama camp. They had no idea we were doing this thing. We just did it.
I didn't know that.
And no, they
and nobody approached. That's
no,
fantastic.
No,
that
no.
makes it even better.
Well, we just did it, you know. Got a lot of hits, got a lot of attention. Didn't hear anything from the campaign or Obama or anything, but it was out there getting some news attention and everything else. And suddenly we got word that the Obama campaign had asked Funny or Die if they could buy time on TV Land during the Andy Griffith marathon.
Wow.
And run it, and Obama would endorse it. You know, he would approve this message.
Right.
And they did that. They bought the 3.5 minutes or whatever, and they ran it on an
interesting strategy. The Southern States, the show set in.
Well, I always thought that there was something about the generations and so forth.
Well, that is
you know,
well,
that we
yeah.
would might be able to cut through and make that point. And I also knew that it was going to annoy some people, as I am sometimes annoyed when celebrities are shooting their mouth
off. Sure,
of course. But I just felt, it's my 50th year in the business. I started when I was 4.
Unbelievable.
And I've never utilized celebrity in that way, but I just felt that, you know, I'm so compelled by this candidate and this election that I wanted to do it, and particularly with the support of Henry and Andy, I felt we just had to. And then... to have, you know, had it be used on the Andy Griffith Show and approved by Obama, you know, in some weird way, I felt like it was It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah, you know, there's your Capra moment.
Well, here's why we did the show all those years. maybe to help get this guy elected because the show would still have enough viability, you know, all these years later.
Oh, that's great. That's a terrific answer. We talked earlier off camera about the digital world today, you know. When you look out and you see where you've come from, when you look at those old big cameras that you shot those shows with, I mean, and where we are today with this micro technology that we're using, how do you look at it as a filmmaker? Is it daunting to you, or do you say, I embrace this?
Just liberating.
Liberating.
It's just liberating. But, you know, it doesn't really change all that much. The fundamentals of trying to, you know, understand a story well enough to stage it, get it in pieces on whatever your recording material is, and build it into something you can, you know, you can offer people.
Right.
That it really hasn't changed. And when I was doing Cocoon, which was 1983 or 4, I was working with a guy who was then 96 years old. Played a small part in the film. He was still driving. He was like a member of the Chamber of Commerce in St. Petersburg, Florida.
Right.
His name was Charlie. I don't remember his last name. And Charlie had been a salesman all his life. And I started to learn more and more about him. Charlie had been too old to be in World War One.
Oh, man.
That was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And Charlie had been in an actor in the film business before it moved to Hollywood, when it was based in New York.
Wow.
And I thought, oh my God, that's fantastic. And he said, I did a little bit parts and I helped out on the crew and but I did it for a couple of years. And I said, well, must have changed a lot. And he said, same bullshit. You know, hurry up and wait.
Hurry up and wait.
He said it really hasn't changed. It's acting in front of a camera.
Right.
And it's getting what you want on, you know, what the director wants on the camera. The only difference is we used to be able to talk through the takes. If you were off camera, no one shut up.
Silent movies.
Now you have to shut up. That was about the only thing that bugged him about it.
Oh, that's great. That's a great answer, Ron. Do you have a wish list of projects? Like you'll see something or read something and go, wow, I want to do this.
Well,
and it's always like, you know, it gets put to the bottom of the pile because the next movie takes its place.
Well, yeah, I mean, I do. I've got two or three things that I'm nursing along that are really challenging. And they may never actually be good enough on paper to make. You know,
original ideas or books that you've optioned?
Original ideas.
Okay.
Original ideas of mine that I've, you know, been working on for some time. But it's what's great about my partnership with Brian Grazer and being involved with Imagine Films is,
right.
You know, we've got a handful of really talented executives that are constantly looking at stuff for us to, as a company to make, for me as a director to work on.
Right.
And, you know, Beautiful Mind was something that Brian developed for the company and because he loved the idea. You know, I wound up coming into that one. So,
right. So
you know, the environment around Imagine Films is really creative and really stimulating, and it's a kind of a think tank. You know, I mean, we're always trying to come up with stuff, and we're always talking to people who are coming up with stuff. And
right.
and so it's, you know, it's much less a manufacturing entity than it is an idea factory.
Right. Yeah, I like that. And being on the East Coast and West Coast, how does that play into it?
Well, we moved here in 85, Cheryl and I, and I really love it. And I still spend a lot of time in L.A.
Right.
Three of my four kids live in L.A. Because my acting daughters, Bryce and Paige, are out there
right. Pursuing
their careers. And so we're there a lot, and I like Los Angeles, grew up there. But I love the creative energy around New York. I feel when I'm in Los Angeles all the time, the indexing of talent and sort of the career indexing.
Mm-hmm.
It's up, it's down,
right.
It's up, it's down. That eats at my stomach a little bit.
Right.
I mean, it distracts me a little bit. And Brian thrives in that. You know, it's been a really good partnership. And he's been, even though he in some ways would like me to be out there sort of helping run the company a little more and being a little more accessible, he's also always said, it's kind of good for you to stay a little removed, you know, stay a little creatively pure. And
creatively pure, yeah. East Coast purity.
Well, it's so easy to start thinking, you know, you hear an idea and the first thought can be, you know, what will the studio think? Can they sell it? What would the marketing be? And blah blah blah. As opposed to, you know, just wow, is that a great, rich, new idea or not?
Mm.
And I
have any of that influence on you. Yeah.
If you're around it, you're eventually going to think about that.
Right.
I mean, it costs a lot of money to make any film,
right.
know, on any level. You got to take it into consideration. But, you know, you don't want it to become, manufacturing. And if you start thinking of it as a product to be sold,
right.
first and foremost, then I think that something's gone wrong, and
the film's
going to feel
it.
I think so. I think the
Looking back on everything, do you ever say, God, I don't remember doing this scene, I mean, doing this episode of Andy or Happy Days?
Yeah, I do. I bump into episodes that I really, you know, I really have to watch it. And then as memory of it returns, it's not really ever about the scene. It's about whatever's going on around the scene.
Right.
I was even watching an episode, bumped into an episode just the other night with my wife, Cheryl. And she said, oh, let's watch it. I said, oh, really? Oh, come on. And we're watching it, and I'm watching it, and I'm saying, oh, Barney's there with a slingshot. Oh, the glass is going to break behind it. And I remember Reggie, the prop guy, had one of these little air guns. And just as Don did that, he fired the little air gun and broke the glass. And so for me, you know, I it's kind of like home movies where it stimulates, you know, all kinds of memories.
Oh, that's great. That's a great answer. How did you and Brian become partners?
Well,
was that forced by the studio?
The partnership grew out of making two movies together, and our first movies for sort of major studios. I'd made a film for Roger Corman and three TV movies,
right?
And Brian had been like an exec producer on a feature film, but not the point guy, and done a couple of produced some TV movies as well, and. And we, you know, we bumped into each other and got Night Shift made.
Mm.
And it was really sort of navigating the Hollywood gauntlet to actually get a movie greenlit within the studio system.
Right.
Was really something. And then we followed that up with Splash, which in a lot of ways was even more challenging because people just thought the idea was so weird of a guy and a mermaid.
Right.
And
yet we look back on it like it was, you know, no big thing.
You know, but the partnership didn't get formalized for another couple of years after Splash, but it was really forged out of making those two movies. But, you know, a lot of the movies that we've made together, Brian and I, that you look back on, everybody looks back on and says, well, of course those were hits. Those were high concept ideas. But people thought this mermaid idea was kind of lame. You know, I mean, they didn't really get that.
Yeah, you had Hard Sell It, huh?
I had Cocoon, which was about a bunch of senior citizens and a spaceship. It wound up being a top 10 movie that year and nominated for some awards, Academy Awards and so forth, and Guild Awards. But, you know, it was kind of not what anybody's idea of a high concept idea at the time. And even 8 Mile, which was Brian's baby,
right?
You know, Eminem starring in a movie,
right.
And it's kind of it's about rap, and at that time, you know, that hadn't broken through, and
right.
You know, that was a leap on the studio's behalf to do that. And of course, Beautiful Mind, you know, drama about the internal struggle against a schizophrenia, you know, and it wound up not only being an award movie but being incredibly profitable. Apollo 13, the only sort of precedent for that one was The Right Stuff, which was a great movie, but had almost brought the studio down. It had performed so poorly at the box office, which, you know, always surprised me because I thought it was just a genius film.
Mm.
So we went into that movie sort of saying, well, we hope, you know, we hope we're as good as The Right Stuff, but, you know, we hope there's an audience. And it turned out there really was one. So
yeah.
I'm sort of proudest of the movies that Imagine that are now viewed as, well, those were obvious slam dunk ideas.
Yeah.
But we know
were
sort of gambles.
Maybe today, you know, looking at the new movies, these Dan Brown movies, those are a slam dunk. But yeah, again, the daunting nature of adopting and adapting a book.
Well, you know, I think, you know, whenever you're going to make an adaptation of, you know, something that's so popular, unless you just get incredibly lucky with some stroke of creative insight, I think you kind of know you're going to get discounted a little bit by people who are going to say, well, didn't live up to my sense of it based on the book, but those stories just offer such a, you know, they're great life experiences. Creatively, they're fascinating, and in a world where studios, you know, really only want to invest large sums of money on projects that they feel they know they can market, you know, that tends to lead towards superhero movies and, you know, our broad genre comedies.
Right.
To have something that the studio is so enthusiastic about really feels they can market, and so forth, is that's dealing with ideas as interesting as, you know, behind the scenes of the Catholic Church and Conclave. You know, should you embrace dogma fully, or should you question it? Mm-hmm. How is that dogma, arrived at historically? You know, what were the steps to establishing, you know, those basic rules and principles? That becomes an interesting creative opportunity.
Yeah, good. Well, I think we've got it. Yeah. Ron, I want to thank you for being on the Culture Catch today.
Beautiful.
Good luck to you. I hope you get a lot of awards for Frost Nixon.
Oh, well, that's nice of you to say. We're really knocking on the door.
And when Angels and Demons comes out, same thing.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
See you soon. I'd like to thank today's guest, Ron Howard. And if you enjoy our programming here at Culture Catch, please visit us at iTunes. We could use your comments. They help in our ranking. Just visit iTunes, type in Culture Catch into the iTunes search bar, and vote for our audio and video podcasts. And look for more compelling content in written form at culturecatch.com. Plenty of reviews in all areas of the arts, and much, much more. This is Dusty Wright. I hope you enjoyed the show. We'll see you soon. Converge is the word.